This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least three times a month, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 495, we have a preview of the March 2026 edition of Retinal Physician. Retinal Physician can be found online and in print at retinalphysician.com. We have a good discussion today. We have a couple of different topics hopping around. Very happy to be joined by Drs. Kat Talcott and Priya Vakari for this episode. As a reminder, episode 500 is coming up. We're looking for listener questions that you can click on the link in the episode description to leave an audio question. If you want us to read the question for you, we're happy to do that. If you don't want your voice on the podcast, we'd love to get your voices on the podcast for that special episode. So look out for that link. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is back with a preview of the March 2026 edition of Retinal Physician. As always, these articles can be found online at retinalphysician.com. Happy to be joined by two of my friends around the country. First, Dr. Kat Talcott in Cleveland. Kat, welcome back.
Happy to be here again. Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Priya Vakari is in Tampa. Priya, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We've got four articles here, and these are not designed to be like journal club type reviews. These, you can go read the articles if you'd like to. These are just designed to be very brief summaries, and then we'll discuss. I'm going to jump right into probably the most data heavy one, which is bicistronic gene therapy, dual pathway gene therapy, GA. This is by Tom Chula. An approach currently being investigated would combine neuroprotection and complement modulation is the subtitle. Just for clarity, Tom Chula is president and CEO of the UK-based gene therapy company that's developing dual pathway treatment. So he does have a disclosure there that's important. So I won't belabor this, but essentially there's some discussion of why GA happens. There's discussion of the complement system, which again, for those of you who haven't been awake in the last 5 years, we know that complement inhibition does regulate GA as seen with two FDA-approved products in that space. And then that he then goes into talking about limitations of what we do currently. And, you know, some of the limitations we've talked about, you have to do persistent injections, that there is the risk of wet conversion, and that it's a single pathway, which is the same criticism that's been done in the anti-VEGF space for the VEGF-A. And that's a lot of the discussions taking care of theirs. You know, should we be targeting other pathways? So he then goes finishes by talking about this gene therapy that to simultaneously expression of affecting two pathways, the PEDF pathway, which is pigment epithelium derived factor, and CD46, which is also going to do complement inhibition. They use an AAV8 vector, but it has to be given subretinally, which we can talk about, and then goes into evidence supporting why this might be a good way to go. Talks about precedent for gene therapy, which we can talk about separately, subretinal gene therapy, especially RGX program for anti-VEGF gene therapy. And then perhaps this could be done in other ways. For example, it could be applied to RP patients. It also could potentially target wet AMD if you change essentially what targets you're targeting with your viral vector. Anyway, I'll start with you, Priya. I mean, we don't have to get into the weeds with the pathways, but I mean, like, I think I would start. I don't think any of us would disagree that there is an unmet need. I mean, there's always unmet needs. That's why we're doing research, right? Like, people don't pursue pathways or research if they feel they've reached the finish line. There are clearly still limitations to what we do. I think no one, no matter how company affiliated, would tell you that, for example, either Syfovre or Izervay reverses damage. I think we are going to see five-year data at Macula Society in a week, and probably by the time this releases, that will be out for Syfovre. But, you know, there's definitely benefits, but it's slowing progression. That's sort of the tagline. So, and I don't think they're promising that they won't just slow progression here. The question is, are they going to slow it more to get any sort of more to squeeze, to juice per squeeze? And then is this delivery mechanism preferable? So let's start with the first topic, which is, do you think that there's a ceiling effect to how much you can slow progression, right? Because I think that in the VEGF, pre-anti-VEGF era, there was sort of a ceiling effect to how much you could slow progression. They tried macular laser, and then they tried PDT, and then there was Macugen. But there was sort of like, at some point, slowing progression, you can only slow things so much. So do you think that this could be additive from a pathways perspective? Like how much would it have to slow for you to be like, oh, this is a big changer over complement inhibition alone?
I mean, I think that when I hope that we can stop progression, I think you're probably right. I think there's probably going to be some progression no matter what. But for me, anything, especially early results, I think would be meaningful. I think what's missing right now is we have therapies that are progressive, that are helpful, but they are helpful over time, and we're talking years, and these patients are older. So a lot of these patients are saying, well, is it worth it? Am I going to be alive in 4 or 5 years? So I think if we had a therapy, even if it's not 100%, even if it's 50% effective, right? 50% slowing of progression, 60%, but it works more rapidly, and we could actually see a tangible result early on, I think that would be really meaningful.
What do you think, Kat? Like, do you think, is that enough of a goal?
I mean, I'd want to see functional benefits over like, 2 years as well, like change in visual acuity, change in contrast sensitivity, reading speed, something like that. I think the other thing that I find, and like you guys, I'm sure, with our GA patients, there's just a lot of chair time. It's also like, what's the potential benefit versus getting injections every month or two, in which people don't like injections and somebody needs to bring you into them. I think the bar is a little different for something maybe like a one and done treatment, which I think is personally attractive in the GA space, because I feel like I think would be, it's an easier sell in my mind of risks and benefits to do a procedure once for a patient, and then feel like that's turned on, and then they don't need to come in all the time for injections with family members. I also, if you worry about sort of gene therapy, maybe making someone more prone to sort of like inflammation or whatever, these are also older patients. I worry about that less than our sort of younger patients, So I think the idea in general of sort of a one and done treatment for GA is very exciting. And I think our bar might actually end up being a little different for results and efficacy, though I would want to see, ideally, I'd want to see a little bit more of a functional benefit.
And important to be clear, he talks about at least theoretically, PEDF would reduce wet conversion risk. So if that's a barrier for anyone who's like, I don't want to do complement inhibition because I'm worried about wet conversion, if this bore out in trials that had a lower rate of wet conversion, that's helpful. But I mean, let's go back just to the delivery mechanism, right? So like one of the criticisms of the subretinal delivery Priya is like, first of all, again, older patients, could they be healthy enough? But I think we've gotten really good about doing vitrectomy under more minimal anesthesia over time. It's not necessarily a long procedure once you get comfortable with it. I just think again about like broad applicability when OR access is such a problem in the United States, right? So it's like how many patients, I mean, that's the same thing REGENXBIO has had to consider, which is why they've looked in a suprachoroidal over subretinal, right? Like if they're going to do subretinal, obviously the population of GA is smaller than your population of like wet AMD and DME patients. So in theory, you could capture a greater percentage of those patients here. It's just like how realistically, like how many of these would you do? Again, that sort of limits sort of the scope to what it changes in our day-to-day practice. It doesn't then act as a replacement. It's just an adjunct for a patient who is maybe not able to come in all the time for injections or has gotten injections over time and slowed progression, but they're, the burden's getting too high.
I think it all depends on the efficacy, right? The efficacy, and if there's visual acuity benefit, like Kat was mentioning. I think that if there was, and we could actually make a meaningful change, I think, at least for me, I would find time to do these cases because it's going to create a positive change for the patient. And also, we know subretinal gene delivery is probably less inflammatory than intravitreal or suprachoroidal. And so there is some benefits of doing gene therapy subretinally. You're correct. It's going to be a logistical burden. And there are going to be patients who just say no thank you purely because it's surgery, and patients tend to be surgery averse. I think it really, at the end of the day, we're dealing with something that we're kind of grasping for anything here that has a visual acuity benefit, really anything. And if you show me a visual acuity benefit, I'm going to be really excited, regardless of the way that I have to deliver the gene therapy.
Kat, do you agree? Like, let's say it's like, hey, you get one line or two lines back. I mean, obviously you would do it, but like, how many people could you get to? Like, how do you prioritize that? Like, if you're in an institution where it's like, I have ERMs, I've got Mac holes, I've got IOLs, I got RDs, but now I could do this therapy that's really fast and really quick and meaningfully changes vision. Like, does that change what we do on a day-to-day basis?
I'm just smiling because, there is a treatment that we can do for intermediate AMD patients that does improve vision. It involves subjecting them to light, and they have to pay out of pocket for it. That's one of our other articles. That's why I'm
That
just
that's a great
smiling because
segue.
it's
Well,
funny.
I'm laughing because do you actually, well, I mean, not to, and we can continue talking about this, but that the other article is controversies in care. Can photobiomodulation actually regulate dry AMD? And there's Colicello, Rossi, and Bernstein, and they go through what you're talking about, Valita, right? Valita PBM for dry AMD, intermediate dry AMD, to try to prevent progression of disease. They go through what PBM is. If you're not familiar with LightSAIT-3, double masked sham-controlled study used for patients with or without non-foveal GA. There are 148 eyes included, 100 eyes, excuse me, 100 patients. Mean gain of 5.4 letters. However, the sham group also gained 3 letters. 24 months, it was 5.9 letters in the PBM group, 1 letter in the sham group. There was an increase in drusen volume in the sham group versus the PBM treated group, and the GA incidence was higher in the sham group versus the PBM group. And then they get into how the fact that most of the gains were up front in both groups, the sham group and the PBM group, and they're very, very small improvements, and it had a very good safety profile. And then they get into discussion. Rossi argues very eloquently why that you need more data, that we shouldn't just jump in and do PBM. There's not enough data here. It's a very small study. And then Bernstein says, look, we need to think about it. We probably need to study it more, but use the criteria from the study, visual acuity between 23 and 2070, the presence of 3 medium drusen or 1 large drusen, in the absence of CNV central GA. And if we use all these criteria, then you may be following the study more religious, more kind of in a regimented fashion. And then over time, maybe we can expand it. And he ends by saying a lot of things were initially poo-pooed in the past, and then over time we adopted them and now they're mainstays. He talks about macular hole surgery for a while. So going back to UCAT, sorry, big aside with a summary because it ties in. So you're right, but do you think the reason that we don't use PBM is because people don't believe the results of the LightSide trial? Or do you think the reason that people don't do PBM because it's too difficult or hard to do and the juice isn't worth the squeeze? Because I would argue it, I've heard the former over the latter.
Yeah, no, that's why it's just, I think, funny to me. I mean, so disclosure, we don't have a device. And I do, it's funny because on the GA, landscape, we all talk about wanting functional benefits, but here there's something. But I, to be honest, I'm not convinced by the trial data that that vision benefit is true. And I think the authors of sort of the article that we reviewed, I think brought up some interesting points, which is that you shouldn't see a visual benefit without seeing a reduction in like drusen volume and like some other like anatomical changes as well. And I think they also highlight things that, other people have highlighted at various conferences, but a lot of the patients who got visual acuity gain in these studies got it within the first month, which seems atypical, right? Like if you're really having a gain, it should be gradual. It shouldn't be like right away. And I think that calls into question, there is some natural fluctuation of when you check people's vision. I mean, I tell my patients with AMD that all the time, like my retina patients who have intermediate AMD or GA, I was like, sometimes there's good days and there's bad days. It depends on like, are your eyes dry? How patient is the person who's checking your vision? Are you like moving your head around or are you not? And so I think they do a nice job of just mentioning some of the concerns that, I mean, I for sure have, and I think others do too, just about these trials. And so for those reasons, to be honest, I'm not very excited about this. I think it's a vulnerable population. It's not covered by
Yeah.
insurance, and I'm just not convinced that it like makes a difference. So yeah.
Priya, what are your thoughts on PBM? Because I think one of the things I've also heard is, and this may not just be done by retina doctors. And I actually have seen anecdotal people reporting they have other doctors in the community offering this, and that raises a really interesting discussion. Like, should this be under the purview of retina doctors, or is it better to have it available to everyone? Because then you can treat more patients and access more patients, and retina doctors aren't really that excited to do this anyway. What are your thoughts? Because one could argue that you would want a retina doctor involved if there were significant safety events, but I can't stand on that leg because there weren't really any safety events like wet conversion or things like that were really noted in the treatment group over the sham group.
And again, for disclosure, we don't have one of these devices. I do feel strongly that, especially macular degeneration, which is one of our biggest patient categories, should stay with a retina specialist. And so I do think that, I think the data is interesting. I still, like Kat said, I'm still not totally convinced, but I don't think there's significant harm, at least that we can tell. And so I'm kind of conflicted with this, right? I don't really believe in it. I do believe that retina specialists should be involved. I believe we should have control over this condition. I believe that we know GA, right? We can see GA development. We can see early CNV development, and we can tell when other things are going on. We can also rule out if they actually have AMD. A lot of these patients, don't need red light therapy. Maybe they just have small drusen and they don't actually have true macular degeneration. And you bring up an interesting point. What happens if the retina community turns away? Is this going to become like a general eye care thing? I don't know. I think some of the barriers here, though, are also the high treatment burden for patients. And honestly, from a practice standpoint, the incredibly high cost of the machine for a practice to purchase, and it's not
Yes.
even affordable, right?
Yeah.
So when you look at a machine and the cost versus the reimbursement versus lack of insurance in your payer mix, it becomes really difficult to justify purchasing a device, which I think has also been an issue for random practices.
I don't know if you guys on Instagram or social media, if you guys have targeted ads for the red light therapy for your skin, improving your glow. Maybe that's just me as like a 40-something year old person who gets targeted those ads. But somebody mentioned to me recently, maybe we should just all buy those devices and give them to our AMD patients. They're probably cheaper than using PPM.
Actually, there are, and this brings up a whole separate discussion. I have patients who come in here with red light glasses off of Amazon or off of wherever, and they say, "Is this going to work?" And I don't even know what to tell them. But there are knockoffs also online, and that brings up a whole separate question. I don't even know what to say to those patients. I usually say, "Hey, this was not studied, and I'm not even convinced of the actual device yet." Although I do think the evidence is compelling, and I do think we should have an open mind in retina, right? And I think our patients deserve that, and I am very willing to take the data with an open mind. But especially glasses from Amazon, I'm like, I don't know what those are about. I don't even know if they have a red light in it. So I do caution patients to use things that are not technically for the eye.
And to your point about like if people are asking for it and there's some money involved, if we don't do it, then someone else will do it. A great example would be like YAG for vitreous floaters. And then the other thing I would say that's not a good example is uveitis, because even if the retina community turns away from uveitis, I don't think anyone's running to do uveitis. However, there's this great article, which is great for three non-uveitis people to talk about. I apologize to Akshay, who was not included in this discussion due to scheduling, but it's called Why Uveitis Fellowship Deserves a Second Look, by multiple uveitis specialists, including John Gonzalez, Jessica Shantha, Shruthi Arpali, Edmund Choi, and Paulina Lieberman. And they go through all the things. They basically counter three myths about uveitis. One, that there's not surgical opportunities. Two, that they're poorly compensated. And three, that uveitis is difficult to manage. And they have some interesting survey data, like what's the percentage of salaries? And you can look at this if you want to get the numbers. It's kind of interesting. But people still do pretty well. Physicians are still very fortunate in a lot of fields and ophthalmologists to do pretty well. And then they go into whether uveitis is hard. I think it's interesting to have five uveitis specialists talk about whether uveitis is hard, because I feel like most people, not that they're not humble, but I think most people gravitate towards something they don't find exceedingly difficult. But they did have some data that, there's structured training, there's residency education portal, there's a lot of educational resources for uveitis. So all that being said, Kat, are you ready to drop everything and start your uveitis fellowship now?
The one of the things I like best about the place that I practice is I'm pretty sure that now we have more uveitis specialists than any other group in the country. And so it
Probably.
means
You have
that I
five?
don't
No, seven?
There's like some people who do it like a little bit, but
Yeah.
definitely north of five. So basically I don't have to see any uveitis, but I love them dearly and appreciate them. I like this article. They were so enthusiastic about how amazing uveitis is. They see like you could just tell the happiness was like
Uveitis
coming
specialists,
off the
if you
pages.
ever hung out with uveitis people or gone to uveitis meeting, uveitis people are like some of the nicest people in ophthalmology. Like their meetings are like super cordial. When they disagree about things, they're super polite about it. Like these are amazing people. I just think it's a tough, I feel it's again one of those things where you either like it or you don't. And if you love it, you do it. I do think you can think about like, are you having unmet needs if you don't have enough uveitis specialists? Let's encourage more people to do uveitis. But I think we have bigger issues in ophthalmology, namely that aren't relevant for retina, but like pediatric ophthalmology, neuro ophthalmology that kind of exceed uveitis. Because as Kat says, a lot of people can cover uveitis to some degree. But I'm curious, Priya, were you more, did you feel any sense of FOMO and loss that you didn't do a dual fellowship?
So I have to tell you, I was considering it for a while and I didn't just based on timing. And I think most of us, like you said, can do most of the uveitis. I don't have any FOMO because usually the uveitis that I am confused by, I maybe a uveitis fellowship would have helped me, but truly, these are some of the smartest people in our field. And I feel like I'm very happy to send these patients out. You know, for example, I just had a patient. I could not figure out what was going on. I sent it to a uveitis specialist and he had Drusen. You know, these are
Oh, that's great. I mean,
complicated.
it's not great for the patient, but what a cool diagnosis.
An amazing diagnosis, right?
Yeah.
And I think that the people who go into uveitis are brilliant. And I really respect them and I'm glad that they're here. I think all of us should be comfortable treating and managing most uveitis, right? I think we should be comfortable managing all of the infectious uveitis, white dot syndromes, et cetera. And I think most of us can. But beyond that, of course, having a uveitis specialist is helpful.
Yeah, I will say this, Kat, because we've talked a lot about residency education. I mean, again, not to be old man barking at a tree. I don't know what the phrase is. Old man yelling at the moon. I don't know, something like that. Old, something involving an old man. But I would say that it should be a basic requirement. And I think it's tested in boards, oral and written, but I feel like people lose this. I feel like not just for retina, for any ophthalmologist in practice, it's a basic requirement to know how to triage every single one of these things. You should know how to triage a third nerve. You should know how to triage a possible GCA. And yes, you should know how to at least triage uveitis so you know what's urgent and not urgent. And I think that's the part that sometimes is the missed gap. And if you look at a lot of infectious sort of conditions, they're misdiagnosed, like ARN, endogenous endophthalmitis. Like a lot of times they're just misdiagnosed as uveitis NOS. Like someone just sees them, they like see some cell and they start drops, and like you're doing the patient a disservice. And sometimes you can't refer the patient right away, but if you have access and you don't know what's going on, it's okay to send them out. But I think you also need to be able to do some basics of just like, okay, is this something dangerous? It's not. Okay, this is what I can do, and this is how I'm going to bridge this. And I feel like unfortunately, as we get more and more super specialized, that people are either more unwilling to do this or just lose that skill set or never develop it. Because that's like a really important thing. Because again, most uveitis is not an emergency, but for the ones that are urgent, those are the ones, unfortunately, I feel like a lot of times there's a lapse, and it's not so much a problem that that person couldn't figure it out, because it's not that they should have been expected to figure out. It's just having a spidey sense to be like, okay, this is potentially something bad. And I feel like, again, maybe we just see more of it in retina because we're uveitis adjacent to some degree, like Priya was saying. But I feel like I hear more about ophthalmologists missing those sort of things than ophthalmologists missing like life-threatening neurodiagnosis, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I think also the more you kind of progress in your career, you get really comfortable with like the bread and butter stuff, you know? And I think when you're coming out of training, I think you're reasonably, hopefully, facile with at least like ruling out an infection, those sorts of things. But I think as time goes on, if something doesn't quite fit into sort of your normal rubric, then you haven't maybe ordered all the labs in a while, or maybe you feel like maybe the workup is different now than it used to be, and that sort of changes. I also think one of the things that was interesting to probably maybe why the authors were inspired to like write this article is, you know, specifically about uveitis fellowship itself. Because I know, like, I've watched my uveitis colleagues, you know, when our department kind of goes through the uveitis match every year. I know that some years there's more applicants than others, but there's not a lot of people applying for sort of uveitis fellowship. And I think that one of the other reasons why people are less likely to look at sort of uveitis fellowship is, you know, maybe if they're doing a retina fellowship, they're going to a retina fellowship where they're getting good enough uveitis training where they don't feel like they need to do a separate year, you know, to the educational piece of like extending by another year, delaying,
Right,
you
right.
know, attending level compensation for like another year. So, you know, I think that part of the reason maybe they were inspired to write this article is that there's probably something that comes along with doing a true dedicated year where you're part of the uveitis community, you feel more comfortable doing the things. But I think a lot of people keep in mind when they're choosing a fellowship or whatever
Right,
their
right.
training looks like to get some uveitis exposure, but maybe not a dedicated year.
Yeah, and I think there's gonna be people listening who are like, well, and I think you would agree with this, that you're not saying that it's equivalent to have uveitis exposure during a dedicated year, but for the purposes of that individual person, they're like, I am going to do this much, but not all of it. This may be enough to get me to that point. No different than some people who go to a retina fellowship that allows them to screen and treat ROP, but that doesn't mean they feel comfortable taking care of every pediatric retina problem out there. And so they're not gonna do a pediatric retina fellowship after retina.
Right.
Yeah. Let's end with everyone's favorite wet AMD variant, PCV. This is a really, really short article, but it's very good by Julia Grigori and Jay Shablani about diagnosing and managing polypoidal choroidal vasculopathy. I suggest, again, everyone read it if you need a PCV refresher. And they go through a few things. I think the most useful is when to suspect it. And they talk about, you know, an orange nodule, serous or serous inguinous PEDs, bilateral involvement. I would add, younger patients with wet AMD kind of presentation. I would add people with peripheral sort of exudation that to be on maybe I call it PCV spectrum. They're probably on this spectrum, and they talk about the diagnostic criteria. There's actually very formal diagnostic criteria. They talk about the Asia Pacific Ocular Imaging Society has three major OCT findings that have high specificity and positive predictive value: ring-like lesions beneath RPE, on-fast OCT complex RPE elevations corresponding to a BVN, which is a branching vascular network, and sharp peaked PEDs, which again, people have said historically you need ICG, but a lot of times ICG is just not available. And this may be helpful to sort of detecting these patients. Treatment is a different question, right? And this is what I want to ask you guys about. They have the best acronyms for for PCV studies. You have Everest, you have Planet, you have Planet Everest 2, you have now Laptop, which I think is cool. And then they talk a little bit about some of the sub data from Hawk and Harrier for brolucizumab. And then from Tenaya, they have the Japanese subgroup where they can look at this. I think it's interesting, Kat, but I feel like, I mean, it's a good thing, but I feel like it used to be more of a discussion of like, oh, okay, EDT plus ranibizumab is superior. Really need to think about combo therapy. You're doing a disservice if you're just injecting. But then as we moved on to aflibercept and as we moved on to faricimab, and now we're talking about high dose aflibercept, I feel it's like become less of a relevant conversation. Like, first of all, you can't get PDT in a lot of places. I don't know if you guys have access to PDT, but it's harder and harder to find a place that will do PDT. Second of all, there's downsides to PDT. It's not without risk. Third of all, most of these people do fine without PDT. I've still used this PDT at times. I've tried to use it and with some success to get patients who are on injections with PCV a little bit of extension or to improve their responsiveness, but it's not like every PCV spectrum patient is getting PDT. I think in a way it's become a little more boring, which is good. I don't know what your thoughts are on the treatment side of that. The diagnostic side of it is more interesting because it's kind of proving that you kind of don't need ICG for every single patient.
Yeah, I think that there's some changes, as you mentioned, with treatment and diagnosis that have for sure changed. I think harder for people to get access to PDT and anti-VEGFs work really well. I definitely, use anti-VEGFs as sort of my mainstay treatment. I feel like PDT, even though we have access to it, it's hard to do. We only do it at our main location. You have to like do the IV. It's just kind of a pain. Similar, ICG is like hard to access at a lot of different places. FA is like so much more widely available. I felt like when I was in training, I think we learned a lot more about PCV than I feel like today's fellows do, because we kind of treat them the same way. It's good to keep in mind and to teach, but the treatment doesn't end up being that different, and the workup isn't dramatically different. And I think, some of the nuances of how you might manage these is a little different. I don't know, Priya, what your approach is.
I think it's just important to like recognize because, these patients can have more aggressive disease, have a higher anti-VEGF burden. I do still think PDT is very beneficial, even in the era of really strong and durable anti-VEGFs. And then I think, sometimes I worry about bleeding much more in these patients. As we know, PCV patients can bleed. And so I think I agree with you, Kat. We treat them very similarly, but sometimes I do worry, for myself, am I missing PCV patients and just calling them AMD? And is this patient going to be someone who I maybe am a little bit more lenient with their anti-VEGF and they're going to come in with a hemorrhage? Usually I think we're pretty good at telling even without an ICG. But sometimes every once in a while I pause to myself and I think, should I be looking for this more than I am?
Yeah, and I think it's like anything you guys are alluding to. If you have a patient who's just not responding the way you think they should be responding, it's good to sort of think about this. I just think like, especially if you're, I wonder in a weird way, because we don't necessarily see a lot of aggressive PCV in the US as our drugs get better, kind of alluding to the very first part of this conversation to bring it full circle, as everything continues to get better. I really wonder if in like 25 or 30 years, if people are going to be sitting and thinking about this, or if it's just going to be under, again, almost weirdly put back under that wet AMD bucket, where it's like all these things respond to this therapy I'm doing, so I'm just going to do this. Which is a little less academically interesting, but maybe the natural side effect, kind of like almost like there used to be the whole classic versus occult CNVM, and this is what you do for this and for that. And then that sort of disappeared after anti-VEGF took over. And it's not a bad thing, but I'm curious what happens. Is it just going to be sort of an academic discussion at some point? Or is it actually going to matter that, okay, we have five pathway agents and one of them's going to work better for this? Maybe. But or maybe it's we're going to have something so good that it will treat all of this and we'll be happy. So Anyway, I appreciate both of you taking the time. It's always a pleasure. Priya and Kat, thanks so much for joining.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks again to Drs. Talcott and Bukharia for joining for this episode. Thanks to our listeners. You make this possible by listening, inspiring conversations here, and taking care of patients every day. Thanks to our whole production team, especially Justin Zhang, Dr. Justin Ma, Dr. Louis Kai. Remember, you can always leave us feedback by emailing at retinapodcast@gmail.com. And remember, you can always leave a question via that Google form in the episode description. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.